Les colloques du Collège de France.
Welcome back. I must say I'm very, very glad to welcome the next speaker, Yacoub Hanna, who is a professor at the Weizmann Institute in Tel Aviv. Yacoub has spent many years to try to understand what it means to be an embryonic stem cells, both in mice and human, and then how can one influence the fate of these cells to further combine them in vitro to build embryo model that was just described by Alfonso a few minutes ago. In parallel with this biological work, he has really pioneered the technology necessary to cultivate these embryos until these embryo models, until developmental stages that embryologists would not have even imagined would be possible still 20 to 30 years ago. The combination of these two aspects has led his laboratory to produce what is thus far the most elaborate type of human embryo models, a fantastic contribution to the field, especially appreciated by those of us who remember that in the late 70s, the main problem cultivating embryos was to go from the zygote to the two cell stages. I'm happy that Yacoub is there today, and I give him the floor. Yacoub.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Denis, and the Collège de France for organizing this really fun and important day. And what I'll describe to you in over the next 40 minutes or so, a bit our work on embryo models, but I'm glad that Alfonso gave the introduction because he did describe importance of why do we need to study embryology and about pregnancy failures and developmental defects. But I actually want to show a different angle that you can reach in the end the same need to make embryo models, which is understanding, basic understanding of what are pluripotent cells and why do they behave. Because in the end, I do believe a lot of we can get a lot more benefit if we understand the rules and of their functional behavior. So just to get everyone on the same page, and when we talk about pluripotency, and this is the embryonic stem cell state, this is a transient state. It doesn't exist in our body as an adult. This is not like adult stem cells in the skin or the blood that we have them. We're talking about the embryonic cells, and this is a transient program. And the fact that we can grow embryonic stem cells in the dish is an artifact, in my opinion. We give the right cytokines, whether it's inhibition of ERK or stimulation of Wnt, to keep them in that state. So this is, I would argue that self-renewal is only an in vitro phenotype. It doesn't really exist in vivo, but it is a very useful artifact because we might use it for making cells and tissue and doing research. And of course, later, you know, embryo pluripotent cells are derived from embryos, but you can have induced pluripotent cells which are reprogrammed from a skin cell or an adult cells back to pluripotency, as Yamanaka showed in 2007. So these are the two cell types we work with. But over the years, us and other groups show that pluripotency, it's not only about cell types, each cell type can have different states, can have different configuration. And this really resembles what happens in the embryo. So you can talk about the pre-implantation configuration, which now we refer to as naive pluripotency, which is the inner cell mass of the blastocyst. But also stem cells exist after implantation until 6.5 or 7.5 in the mouse. And you can see here the embryo has this egg cylinder shape. And you can derive also pluripotent cells. And these are called more primed stem cells, meaning that they're more advanced. They're not differentiated yet, but they're about to. And they have different configurations and different requirements. And what we've learned over the years that actually it's very easy to convert these two cells states in vitro. You can just change the media, whereas basically changing the growth and the cytokines, and you can move naive cells to become primed, or you can take prime cells and revert them into becoming naive cells. And we've learned over the years that the differences between the two states are not subtle. There's a very dramatic differences. For example, X inactivation already occurs in females in the prime state. DNA methylation is increased in the prime state. Metabolism is very different. And at the functional level, actually the earlier ones are the ones that if you inject them into blastocyst, they can give rise and contribute to development. So they're considered more developmentally potent. So after learning a lot about them, and particularly in the mouse because they were available, they started raising questions about what's going on with human stem cells that people worked with. Because conventional human cells were derived, whether ES cells or iPS cells, were much more similar to the mouse prime cells. And they're epithelialized and they're flat. And for years, scientists thought, well, it's about, you know, the years of evolution between the mouse and the human, and we must accept them for what they are because they were derived from a blastocyst. So they must reflect the pre-implantation stage. But as I just showed you, the state is actually dictated in the media you use and basically the state that you create in the dish. So theoretically, it could be that they are being basically progressing into a more differentiated state. And there was a question whether alternative states that can be isolated in human cells that are more similar to the mouse or more naive-like, and perhaps we just didn't have the conditions to isolate them. And just briefly, this has been over, we've been studying this for over 10 years, and really that was, I think, the case. And if we want to look in our opinion, what differentiates naive and prime stem cells is basically how they respond if you block the signaling pathway termed ERK pathway. So if you block MYC-ERK pathway, naive cells prosper and differentiate and they tolerate it, versus prime stem cells, they differentiate. And at the time, we showed that in humans are much more stringent than the mouse. So we need, in addition to the cytokines we use in the mouse, we need to block and stimulate other pathways. That says PKC and P38. It doesn't matter the detail, but just the concept. And really, we were able to make cells that are different from conventional stem cells in the humans. And this media is commercialized, and this is a conflict of interest, I should declare. But what was important that really started to show that there are other pluripotent states difference between the mouse and the human. But we also realized that this is really, and by work also by others, that this is naive state in the humans. We're having a problem of defining it because we don't know exactly what is happening at the time in the blastocyst of the human. Now we know much more with the technology. But there is a question, you know, if you want to make cells more and more naive, what is a naive stem cell state? And this is hard to define in humans, particularly because there's no functional test. In the mouse, I would say any stem cells, if you inject it into a blastocyst, you put it in a surrogate womb, and it makes a mouse, that is naive enough. But obviously, we cannot and we do not want to do such a cell with human cells. And we wonder, what is naivety? And I just want to give a couple of slides about this topic that we were asking, you know, about basic fundamental differences between naive and prime cells in the mouse. And this is a work from Abid Mansour, who's now at the Hebrew University. And we took naive cells and prime cells that have this Oxford GFP reporter. So if they are green, they are non-differentiated. And we started finding, asking, are there genes that are important only for the prime state? So that when we knock them down, the basically you could see the blue columns will basically decrease in their intensity, meaning they don't differentiate. And as you can see in the gray highlighted blocks, there are such genes. And these genes, if you look at them, they have something in common. They are all some kind of a repressor machinery. So if you look at Dicer and also DGCR8, they make microRNAs which degrade RNAs. So they are not important for naive cells, they're important for primed cells. If you look at DNMT1, which makes DNA methylation, which is repressive, it is critical for the maintenance of the prime state, not the naive state. The same with Polycomb, which is a repressive complex. And in this work, we focus on MeTTL3, which makes RNA methylation, which is a form of a repressor. And because it degrades RNA. So this is what's starting to tell us, really, that perhaps naive pluripotency is a very basic configuration, that it doesn't need these, I would call them, fancy secondary modes of gene regulation that evolved later. And even if you look at this, this is a bit reminds us of yeast. So yeast doesn't have DNA methylation, no microRNAs. RNA methylation only during some part of meiosis. Yeast cells can tolerate haploidity very much. So in a way, perhaps naive cells, maybe they're akin to our like unicellular ancestor when we started before multicellularity emerged. So just gives us some concept about what is naivety. But at the functional level, it started telling us perhaps naive cell, it's a cell that it can tolerate ablation of these genes. And that gave us a functional screen we wanted to look for. So really, we made human cells, and in this case, for MeTTL3, the RNA methylase enzymes, we engineered human ES cells, where the expression of this enzyme comes from a transgene, and there's a TET-off promoter, meaning if we give the drug, we shut it off. So you can see here, MeTTL3 is expressed. When we give DOX, it's turned off. Therefore, we can ask then, do a screen, can these cells survive and maintain pluripotency when we give doxycycline? And really, at the time, all previously described cells, whether they were called primed or naive-like, they couldn't tolerate loss of DNA methylation and RNA methylation. So we went back and screened more conditions. And again, it doesn't the details here, but we can have different media called Hansem, which the main difference is really instead of stimulating Wnt, we block Wnt, which is opposite from the mouse. I'm not going to get into why this is the difference, but the bottom line is that we can really close the gap, and I would say that we have different flavors of naive pluripotency, both of the mouse and in the human, and we have ways to isolate them. But then one faces, as a scientist, the existential question of who cares? Why does it really matter? And in another way, if this is, it seems to be evolutionary conserved, why is it? What is the benefit of having these different gradients of pluripotency? Why it's not just 0-1 or on-off situation? And one clear example that it does matter came, for example, in this differentiation protocol from Saito in Japan, who was trying to make PGCs. So these are the primordial germ cells. So these are the progenitors of sperm and egg. And in order to get them from mouse stem cells, after many people tried, he succeeded. And his secret was that he had to follow this sequence. He had to start with these naive cells that are grown into this ERK inhibitor-containing media. He had then to give them priming with FGF activin for about 2 days, similar to the in vivo timescale. And then if he gives cytokines, mainly BMP4, he gives this pulse. You can see he gets these cells that are positive for BLIMP1 and STELA, which are really, he proved that these are PGCs. And this is important. And at the time, this protocol didn't work with human cells. And people thought perhaps it's different time, it's different BMPs. But actually, everybody was trying with the available cells at the time, which were primed cells. But we, and together with Azim Sorani, we had these different alternative naive pluripotent cells, whether it's the old version or the new version. When we took that protocol and started with naive cells, we got human PGCs. So what this really shows us that the starting state of the cells has critical outcome on the success of the differentiation protocol. And the answer, the question is, remains is why, which I think is not fully answered. If we look at the PGC as a paradigm, why is starting with naive cells is critical? Why do we need to go through priming? And why prolonged priming, which if you do more than 40 hours FGF, which is actually most of the human growth conditions, by the way, you get then complete loss of this opportunity. So this is, in a way, you know, theoretically, you're talking about kind of windows of competence for success. And you know, things and cytokines need to be present at the right amplitude, at the right time, in order to have this competence to become a certain lineage. And I want to say this scenario is quite scary for me. Why? Because the reality of differentiation from stem cells is that we are actually having a very hard time to do in vitro differentiation. We can make iPS cells very easily and very normally, I would say, these days, but trying to make progenitors and mature cells for most cell types has proven very, very difficult. That is not to say that it's not possible, and there are some successes. But it has been difficult. Even, for example, hematopoietic stem cells, which we know we can transplant them, and thus we have bone marrow transplant, even in mice, after 40 years, nobody can make good HSCs. And I wonder, maybe there, and it's a much longer journey, you can have, similar to the PGC paradigm, multiple of these windows of opportunity of things having to have at the right time that we are actually not having that in the Petri dish. So, basically, if I describe my problem as a scientist in my lab, I am, in order to study this phenomenon, I want to have everything happening in the Petri dish, but I'm stuck. Because what I do have is I can go from naive to primed stem cells and I can go back, but I cannot get the final outcome of them, which is an embryo-like entity, which is what we call now stem cell-derived embryo model or synthetic embryo model. I will call them SEMs. And if you think of it, it's like an enzymatic reaction. It's A leads to B leads to C. And I would like to have the whole sequence of events so that I can ask about, if I can perturb this reaction at different time points, how does this influence the outcome? But then this, we realize that this is a bit too ambitious, because what I'm asking to do is to take stem cells and make them into an embryo and grow them outside the uterus. But we can't actually do that even with natural embryos, which are taken from the uterus. So we realize that we need to have protocols where we take a post-implantation embryo after the blastocyst and be able to grow it outside the uterus and develop these methods. If we are successful in that, maybe we can go back and try to do this with this stem cell-derived embryo model. Another take on this, a spin, if we think about differentiation, typically differentiation protocols are what we call directed differentiation, which where we pulse cytokines or transcription factors, and we decide when and we decide how. And well, you can argue perhaps we're not able to make HSCs because the cells are not okay, they're not good enough. But that's not really the case, because we now know in mouse, when we take the cells, inject them into the blastocyst, put them in the uterus, they will make embryos that have excellent bone marrow cells. So the problem is not the cells, I would say the problem is us. We are not able to recapitulate and create the environment that exists inside the embryo in the context of a womb to get this successful differentiation. So with all these thoughts in mind, we started carrying a different lines of experiments, hoping that maybe we can have environment to grow post-implantation mouse natural embryo, natural meaning that conception started by fertilization and we take them out of the uterus, and then try to make, in these conditions, embryo-like entities from stem cells in the mouse, and then try to do this with human-derived stem cell models. So these are really the questions we were after, and I'll show you the progress. But what really stands at the center of this dilemma is what's called the uterine barrier. Which is really, we can grow embryos in mammals until the blastocyst stage, but really in all mammals, the gastrulation that Alfonso mentioned in organogenesis happen inside the uterus. This is unlike, you know, fish and frogs. That's why they're very good test models. And the uterus, of course, is not transparent. It is in vivo. We don't really control the environment. The embryo is very, very, very small, and it's really these events, I call it the exciting drama of development, happen just when the embryo enters the uterus. And another complication of this is that in mammalians, if you take out the post-implantation embryo, game over. You cannot put it back. You have to analyze it. You cannot go further. And of course, excuse me. In humans, the problem becomes much more difficult because there are obvious technical and ethical barriers. Women usually don't know they're pregnant at these stages. And if even they want to have an abortion, there's usually no justification to have a surgical abortion. It's really, really hard to get samples. And whatever samples we get, and they're very useful, they're very important to make atlases and references, which we need. But I think they're never going to be a replacement for studying developmental biology, because as we know from mice and other models, you need millions of samples, and you need even genetically engineered samples and labeled samples to really learn a lot about developmental biology. So that's why we started thinking, can we look at it outside the uterus? And I think there was also a question that is in principle, which is, in mammalians in general, can you capture gastrulation outside the uterus? Or is it that the uterus is really needed to dictate the shape of the embryo? And the same we can ask about gastrulation and organogenesis. And for us, because we eventually want to do this from stem cells, it was very important for us to start everything from pre-gastrulation. So when you look at really nice work trying to grow embryos outside the uterus, you can find papers back to 1934 from Dorothea Rudnick, and I think Dennis Dew and Patrick Lam did a lot of progress in the 60s and then another burst in the 90s, but they had very limited success. What they were able to grow, they could grow mouse embryos for about 1.5 days the most, from 7.5 to 9 or from 9 to 10.5, but they could never really get a big span of days. They could never start from pre-gastrulation. They could never capture the entire gastrulation. The process was extremely inefficient, and nearly all the embryos were abnormal. Still, that was a very useful system. For example, Rosa Beddington showed ectopic axis formation by implanting, because for these kind of more crude experiments, you don't need a very healthy embryo. But what we were after, to have a long period of time without delay and with high efficiency. And this work really was led by Alejandro Aguilera Castrojón, who just started his own lab now at HHMI Jamelia in the US. And the idea, let's try to take some of these incubator, modify them, and have much more refined control over parameters, and really decide what are the parameters we needed to control. And this involved different iterations of engineering to really to have this elaborate system where we control different parameters. And what we ended up with, this is a device where you can have the incubator on the side, and it has this red capped bottle which controls the pressure and the humidity. You can have this electronic gas regulation module that controls different gases at different stages. And you have this gas mixing box at the top here, which is very important. The gas need to be very, very mixed when it, well, before it's delivered and pressurized to the surrounding of the embryo. I want to say we make this available for academia for no profit. There's actually now about to come out kind of a more closed-end version from Oculabs that's just much more stable that we have developed. And again, basically we do this for no profit. But what we've learned over the process when the system, that different parameters need to be controlled. So this works very efficiently for like 90% success, but you really need to have dynamic control of oxygen at different states, atmospheric pressure, even if it's low hyperbaric pressure, it's very important for normal embryogenesis. The having the roller is still very, very important. It prevents this embryos from adhering, otherwise they will become distorted. Phototoxicity, is avoiding it is very important. We also had to develop the liquid in which the embryos are growing, because they have a placenta, but they're not exchanging their metabolized through the blood. So this media has rat and human serum. Herpes buffering is very important. High glucose is very, very critical. So if you do this, as you can see, when you start from 7.5, one day later, we get this yolk sac growing, heartbeat. 2 days, the embryo turning, this is the head, these are the feet. You can see heartbeat later with blood, and they can reach day 11, and then they stop growing, they die basically because they're just too large to rely on diffusion. We can actually now reach day 13 in development. This was nice, but this is day 7.5 is late gastrulation, so we really wanted to do this from post-gastrulation embryos. So this is when the system is working. You can see it's the roller wheels and the embryos are inside. And we wanted to start from day 5.5 or 6.5. And there we use these static plates. We use the same media we developed and we grow them until day 7.5 or 8.5. And you can see here how this really works nicely. You can really view gastrulation. This is the embryo. You can see how it really drastically grows. You can see the primitive streak moving and then the somites forming. On the left, what is going the head. This also shows you that how this technology is important for research, because it's going to allow us to see things much more accessibly. And then what we did really novel here was really combining these static conditions, then use the dynamic conditions. And if you do that, you can grow mouse embryos from day 6.5 until day 11, or day 5.5 until day 11. And we've characterized them. These embryos are really, really very, very similar to the ones grown in utero. So in terms of conclusions, this shows us that we can capture gastrulation organogenesis ex utero by combining static and dynamic conditions, and really that embryo development is self-determined, or in other words, that you don't really need the uterus to get the shape of the embryo. The uterus is a very good metabolic support, and it can influence the embryogenesis, but the development is hardwired inside the embryo that is encoded. I'll just give two slides, as Denis also alluded, we're after not just growing or making embryo models, it's about really being able to manipulate and developing technologies. So one thing, just to show you an example we can do, we can take embryos and mutate them and then follow the same embryo over time. For example, we can take 6.5 and inject lentivirus into the proamniotic cavity. In this case, I'm showing innocent GFP. It can be a CRISPR to knock out a gene or two genes. And the embryos really tolerate this well. They get completely labeled. They continue growing normally. And we can really now do knockouts for two or three genes and follow the same embryo every day over time. Because we have control over the environment in which embryogenesis is happening, to show that we can test this for teratogenicity and drug toxicity. So we took the mouse embryo and we add valproic acid, which causes neural defect. And what you see here, within 24 hours, you can see that there are known brain defects that this drug causes, and just shows us how these, again, ways of to use this for research. But then back to the next goal we started tackling, and what was important question for us is really, can you make a convincing embryo-like entity outside the uterus? And there's been really, really great work done from different groups, whether talked about the blastoid models, whether about the ETX model, or about the gastroloid model. And they're very, very useful, and will be very useful. But the question was really, at the time, are these real embryonic developmental dynamism, or is it perhaps just, you know, they have some basic cavitation and so forth, and they're useful, but this is not very closely to an embryo. And therefore, the question, you know, what I say is there was no definitive proof that you can get canonical developmental dynamism from stem cells. And in our opinion, what was really needed to show is really ability to execute bona fide gastrulation and go beyond it from stem cells. And I want to say actually some these models, they don't do it now, and you couldn't test it at the time because, as I told you, post-implantation mouse embryo, even if it's natural one, if you put it inside the uterus, it doesn't implant, so you couldn't test it. But now we have a system, a condition, that allows you to test that, and that is what we wanted to do. And really, at the time, the existing models didn't do that. So we wanted to think, we asked, what should we do differently? So we started thinking of doing this a bit differently. And if you look in the embryo, in the mouse, it has three compartments, the embryo proper, which is going to be like the embryo itself, the primitive endoderm that makes the yolk sac, and the trophoblast stem cells that make the placenta. And what we noticed by working on human naive cells, that these cells can give rise easily to trophoblast stem cells and primitive endoderm cells. And by easily, I mean, unlike in mouse, we don't need to overexpress transcription factors. Therefore, that kind of stimulated us in humans to try and do everything by starting with naive pluripotent cells, rather than to rely on trophoblast-derived stem cells or yolk sac-derived stem cells, also having in mind that if and when we reach humans, a lot of these cell types cannot be accessed and cannot be obtained, and it would be much more advantageous if we can start everything from pluripotent cells. And there, the idea was to take the naive pluripotent cells in the mouse, try to nudge some of them to become trophoblast in 24 hours, try to nudge some to become primitive endoderm in 24 hours, and then put everything together, and as soon as possible, mount them on the same device in the same conditions that we developed and ask what happens to them. And really, I will not get into the details. Some of the important genes are known, for example, CDX2 to push the trophoblast. We use a HIPPO pathway inhibitor that pushes trophoblast stem cells, that Nicola Rivron used it to make trophoblast. And then we basically developed as really some alchemy, and we need to actually put them on a shaker for a couple of days. Shaking is emerging as a very important thing. I would say much more adherent than adherence. We'll talk about with Alfonso later. Reminding. And then at day four, really, we move it to the roller culture that we used. And really, what you see now, now you're seeing the system, instead of looking inside having natural embryos, you can have many of these mouse stems at day eight that are growing, that have yolk sac, that grow inside each of these bottles. And I think this slide is still what delivers the message for me, that what this is showing, we start with 25 cells. And again, the number of cells starting is very, very critical. It has a range, and we don't know why. And in the first 3 days, you think it's only just a ball of growing cells, but if you look closely at day four, you start seeing that it has, when you compare to natural embryo, it has similarity to a natural embryo and the different poles. By day five, you see a very clear primitive streak that is very similar to a natural embryo. 1 day later, you start seeing the amniotic cavity, again, comparing it to a natural embryo. There are differences. I'm not saying they're identical. Day seven, dramatic. You get the yolk sac with an embryo-like entity in it. And day eight and a half is so far what we can get. And here, the major disadvantage of this technology, the one that is very inefficient, and unlike the blastoid and the gastroid models, here you get about 0.5% to 1% efficiency, and we don't understand why, and this is very limiting, because if we want to use this as a research model, you need the numbers. And that's something I think it's solvable, but it's important to acknowledge and highlight that. And again, I'll just briefly just show you what these embryo models look like. You can see here the neural folds, which are the primordium of the brain, the heart, even there are some valves. This is the allantois. You can see even the blood, the first blood stem cells grow inside the yolk sac. These are the blood islets, kind of the cloudy ones. And we've validated that they are just like natural embryos. And we can stain them here, and you can see this is a natural embryo staining sequence, and this is the embryo model. And I want to highlight, you can see that while there are differences and there are defects from the natural embryo, still clearly this is an embryonic-like organization that has access and that the organs are in the right place in relation to one another. And the difference, we are not giving morphogen gradients. This is much more driven by the cells themselves. So, of course, there are a lot of questions about mechanisms and efficiency and how in the world, but we'll skip now to talk about then what happens in humans. I should mention also the work from Zernike Getzer published together, and we are authors on it because we've provided the device and the conditions to allow the growth of these embryo models at these stages. So when we want to do this with humans, and this is work with Bernardo Olduk and Emily and Vlad Bondarenko from the Ukraine, and first, we were lucky, we had solved the first obstacle, which is having naive stem cells. But then we wanted to also to define what are the stages we want to get in embryo development. And again, just to get everyone on the same page, this is what looks embryo development if you look in a YouTube movie. You can see that the blastocyst implant, and now starts being very different from the mouse. Implantation is very deep. The embryo doesn't make the egg cylinder. The epiblast remains flat. And this is the yolk sac. And this is what's going to be called the bilaminar disc. And the rooftop of the blue, this is what's called the amnion, the amniotic cavity. And now we're going to look from the top. That's what it has, a disc shape. That's why it's called the embryonic disc. And towards day 14, you have the primitive streak appearing in the posterior part of the epiblast that start migrating and really setting up gastrulation. There are other differences. For example, if you look here, so you have the bilaminar disc, and suddenly, blackout, you see these orange cells, which are extraembryonic cells. And by the way, this blackout of the screen, it's because nobody knows where these cells come from, so nobody can animate where they come from. So they just appear for us, and just shows us how much we don't know about developmental biology. We know a lot, but there's a lot we don't know. But this extraembryonic mesenchyme, I want to say that it's a very important tissue, and we keep realizing how important it is. It defines also the chorionic cavity. It actually then also defines what is the secondary yolk sac, and more detail. But just to show you that there are really differences between mouse and the human as we go. So then, next, as I mentioned, we started working with this. We had naive stem cells, and we have the old version and the new version, so that at least that obstacle was down. And really, this media was used, and there are other studies that described human so-called embryo models. But that's kind of, if you look at the image of some of these studies, you start wondering, what is an embryo model? Because if this is a clump of cells that maybe the cells are there, but it lacks any organization that reminds you of any of the videos I showed, is this something we should call an embryo model? Is an embryonic body from ES cells for 20 years, should we call it an embryo model? That's not to say it's not useful, but I think not. And in my humble opinion, when we want to talk about an embryonic model, you want to talk about the cell composition. It needs to have different compartments of the embryo, perhaps not all of them, but meaningful compartments. And it's about structural organization. You need to have the structures of the compartment, and you need to have them juxtaposed, correctly oriented to one to another. And I think a third one that I believe in is what I call developmental dynamism, is meaning that they start to develop and make developmental milestones that weren't there from the beginning, make new structures that we didn't start with. And I think this is what we strive for. So when we approach this for humans, we wanted to make also, as I mentioned, there's a new cell type there. This is the extraembryonic mesoderm, which is really, really critical to get these structures. So we needed to think, how do we make each of these cell types? Should we use transgenes? Should we use conditions? And we realized actually in humans, in a way, it's simpler. We don't need to overexpress transgenes, unlike in the mouse. And I will not get into that, just because the reason is the enhancers for these genes are still open in human naive pluripotent cells, as shown by us and by others. And we started optimizing conditions. So this media, which we call RCL, when we incubate naive cells, it doesn't work on primed cells. All what I showed you does not work on primed cells, and this is a consensus between different groups. And if you do this, you will end up with the cell population that has both the primitive endoderm, the SOX17 cells, and the extraembryonic mesoderm, which are the BST2 positive cells. So these two cell types originate together from the same induction protocol. We actually have reason to believe now that actually EXEM comes from the primitive endoderm, but I'll not get into that. And then we started asking, what about trophoblasts we want to use? And just to show you kinds of the alchemy that needs to be done, there are a lot of protocols describing trophoblast stem cells, and they're all true. But some trophoblasts are different. If you aggregate them, and you can see on the left in the pink magenta, the trophoblasts remain clumped. They don't surround the entire structure. But what we want them is the ones, the protocol we adapted to what's called BAPJ protocol, these trophoblasts surround the entire entity. And then you move to another step with how many cell types, of course, again, the cell number, what's the ratio, and we developed a protocol that within 8 days you get structure which we believe are similar. They are not identical to human embryos at day 14, but they definitely, I think, qualify to be called a day 14-like embryo model, and I'll try to convince you. So if we look at first at the stainings, and you can see the OCT4 staining, this is the epiblast, this is the amniotic cavity, this is what I showed, the roof of the amnion, and this is the hypoblast. And the meeting of the blue and the yellow is the bilaminar disc. And again, the bilaminar disc, without it, there can be no gastrulation. And I think this is the most minimal criteria to talk about post-implantation embryo model that needs to have there. And here's the yolk sac, and this is actually the chorion sac, and this is surrounded by a trophoblast cell component. Videos are very helpful. You can see here at day 8, you can see the trophoblast on the outside. And you can see now, this is segmentation of the true staining. You'll see now the true staining afterwards. You can see the blue meeting the yellow. This is the bilaminar disc. And this is the yolk sac in the yellow. And this is the amnion rooftop. And you're now going to see just what is the actual staining look like. So this is segmentation of this staining. You can see the nuclei. And with light sheet microscopy, it's really helpful for us to three-dimension, basically, different sections we can build. And this is, again, very important to look at the structures and really good old developmental biology of really trying to look at structure to evaluate embryo models. And this is now published. We've really made our case why they are similar to, in some cases, to day 9 and why day 12 and day 14 and the different structures. But I want to highlight, when we looked carefully, when we asked, do we go through a blastocyst stage at some point? And we don't, actually. So the first structures that emerge are already looking like post-implantation embryos. So we don't go through a blastocyst. It really shows you that we are, again, this is an artifactual protocol that doesn't follow normal development on that aspect. I don't know what it means, but this is the fact. And I'll show you this couple characterization of compartments. We didn't use natural embryos as reference controls. We were lucky to have collections such as Carnegie collections and other studies and the work of Bernadette that was mentioned. And you can see, for example, the amnion has a much more thinner epithelium. You can see it here in these two sections in our models. You can see the amnion is expressing TFAP2A, not the epiblast, and SOX2 is only in the epiblast. And if we look at the three dimension, again, it's construction of light sheet, you can see the amnion, TFAP2A on the rooftop. You could see this is the epiblast. And when we go with the video, you try to look at this from the top to really see that this is, does it have an embryonic disc shape? And it does. And it's about 80% size similarity to what is expected for an embryo at this stage. I'll just show another example. What about the yolk sac? You can see here, again, the videos are very helpful. We're not going to see the cavity. Here's the cavity. And you can see here is the epithelium is very columnar, and this is the visceral yolk sac, versus the lower part is squamous, basically. It's just parietal yolk sac. And again, this is a section of a real embryo, and you can see how the visceral endoderm is columnar, and these parietal endoderm. And this is, again, developmental dynamism. It shows you that their cells are self-organizing and getting fine details that didn't exist before, and complexity of an embryo. What about anterior-posterior polarity? We can see nicely here's the stalk, which is a structure that is not in the mouse. It holds the posterior part of the epiblast, and the posterior part of the epiblast have brachiori, here in magenta. And there's something called anterior visceral endoderm that is in the hypoblast on the other side that is stained in SER1. So really these embryo models are have polarity of anterior-posterior, and I would say they're not gastrulating, they're about to gastrulate theoretically then to do this. And the last example of a compartment that I'll show you is actually the trophoblast. Again, we don't have a very good cytotrophoblast organization. We have more in situ trophoblast, but they develop these lacuna. Again, not in the mouse. Typically, these cavities get filled with maternal blood, and this is the sections from a real embryo. And you can see them here in this microscopy, and this is the trophoblast, and this is the HCG hormone, and you can see this kind of window that is open. So it's an interspace between cells, and these are the lacuna that are happening there. So I want to just briefly say that, of course, we also do technologies such as single-cell RNA-seq, and they are very important, but they're a must but not sufficient, because mostly they don't tell us about the structure. And really, we have the cell types, and this is work with Sophie and Fredrik. I will not get into it, but this is under, I want to say, not a replacement for microscopy and looking at the structure, even when we do spatial transcriptomics. And a lot of, I think, I caution about a lot of papers making some claims only based on single-cell RNA-seq, and I think that can be problematic and very complex, particularly that we still don't have good reference maps when it comes to human embryos. With that, I want to summarize some of the conclusions. I still haven't answered any of the questions I started with about the PGC competence and naive and primed, but we've learned other things. Perhaps that naive pluripotent cells are de facto totipotent. They have the potential to make also extraembryonic cells, both in mouse and in humans. And that ex-utero post-implantation cultural conditions, working with natural embryos, are important because these conditions taught us how to cultivate stem cell-derived embryo models as well. So still, there's very importance we're working with natural embryos and also for atlases, as mentioned before. But still, that self-assembly of stem cells can have complete and structured embryo models that have a meaningful organization, even if it's far from being identical to a natural embryo. In the cases of the human and the mouse, we can really capture the early post-implantation until gastrulation. In the mouse, as I showed you, we can make complete gastrulation and reach early organogenesis, something that we haven't reached yet in the humans. One aspect that I want to just raise, this technology also raises the question, well, as I said, we're trying to make these models to learn how differentiation works, but is this in itself a differentiation protocol? Meaning, is there, and let's leave the ethics now aside, what if a scenario, what if this process makes very good liver HSCs or very good oocytes? And can we envision one day of a patient coming and donating a skin cell, making an iPS cell, making a naive iPS cell, make an embryo model for the minimal number of days, day 40, day 50, and extract cells that can be used for transplantation, and that are very high quality cells. And this gives, I think, in my opinion, a new route for cell transplantation that remains to be explored. With all of that, of course, we are not blind to the important and serious ethical questions that are raised, and we kind of raised this by taking this famous painting, The Treachery of Images by Magritte, or known, this is not a pipe, because he's starting to argue this is only a drawing of a pipe, another real pipe. And my students' take on this was to say, this is not a mouse embryo, it is a mouse model. Of course, this is not a statement, but it's actually just to raise the idea and the question and the discussion very early on, in the early days, and involve the public, which is exactly what is the purpose of this program, and really to get to do this, to get the benefit of this technology and avoid not crossing lines very early on and defining what these lines are. And with that, I want to thank different lab members throughout the years who worked in many different aspects. I mentioned most of them. Collaborators from Israel, from the Weizmann, outside the Weizmann, in Europe, Frederick Lanner, Sophie Petropoulos, and Vincent Pasquet. And many friends, I want to say, of Denis and Alfonso and Nicolas, that always in continuous discussions and exchanges of ideas and sometimes even arguments, which are really fun, to really formulate our concepts about what we do. And I thank different funding agencies and, of course, the clear conflicts of interest that I have in relation to this topic. Thank you very much. Happy to take questions.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.